This episode of Local Knowledge is presented by Olokai. Olokai, our favorite Hawaiian-inspired sandal brand, is now making golf shoes. And I own a pair of these golf shoes, by the way, the Menil brand in the color Trench Blue. And I would encourage you to go look them up because I'm not really a huge shoe guy. Even I can tell these are gorgeous shoes. More importantly for me, they're very light, they're very comfortable, they have great traction, and I shot my best round ever with them. I don't know if it was 100% the shoes, it may have been a little bit me, but the shoes really are terrific. So bring the aloha spirit to your course. With every step, you'll feel like you're walking along the beaches in Hawaii. Spikeless construction offers great traction and comfort on the course, and Olokai golf shoes transition easily to off the course wear too. They have sporty and classic styles for both men and women. So check them out at olokai.com. That is olukai.com. Again, the trench blue in the Menil style. That's my personal recommendation. And you can use code DIGEST for free expedited shipping. Do you ever have something stuck in your brain that is incredibly unimportant and trivial? There's no reason for it to be there, but at the same time, you know in your heart that it's going to stay forever. I think that's probably familiar to a lot of us. Long after you've forgotten essential details, you know, imagine you're at a family reunion and your cousin's wife approaches and you've met her before, even went out to dinner with her one time, you have absolutely no clue what her name is. Stuff like that flies out the memory hole, but this kind of irrelevant detail stays. It's got some purchase in the brain. Ad jingles are a great example. I still remember jingles from when I was a kid about windshield wipers and things like that. But one of them for me, one of those irrelevant details that'll never leave my head, is just five words spoken by Roberto DiVincenzo after the 1968 Masters. I was not alive for this. There's no reason it should resonate with me. I've basically just seen the words in print, although you can find them in an interview, but they are so poignant and memorable to me that they take up space up there. They're not going anywhere. I'll be on my deathbed and they'll still be there. And the five words are, "What a stupid I am." DiVincenzo was from Argentina, and the fact that the English idiom is just slightly off, "What a stupid I am," makes it even more unforgettable. And it's kind of funny by itself, but in my head it's almost kind of profound. The words may be a little bit inane, but when you know the circumstance, when you know they were uttered just after this guy blew a chance to win the Masters, a tournament he would never win, they become like a cry of the heart. To me, they're more powerful and more poignant than if you saw someone weeping profusely, beating their fists into the ground. "What a stupid I am" is just perfect in its awful way. If you're at all into golf history, you know at least the outline of this story, which is that DiVincenzo, this great Argentine golfer who is actually a little underappreciated, I think, in his time, the guy won 200 times internationally, 7 times on the PGA Tour, won the 67 Open Championship a year before the big snafu at Augusta. I actually did a project about 5 years ago just looking at national opens, from the US Open to the Italian Open to the Argentine Open, everything that has a country in front of it and it's an open, compiled all the likely candidates, and nobody won more of those than DiVincenzo. He won 41 overall and 14 separate ones, so the guy got around. And he was very good. He's a Hall of Famer now. And of course, one of his big moments came in 1968 at Augusta, where he started the final round 2 shots off the lead, shot a 65 to force his way into a playoff with Bob Golby, except he didn't. Because on 17, he made a clutch birdie, but it was marked by his playing partner, Tommy Aaron, as a par, a 4 instead of a 3. And when it came time to review the scorecard, DiVincenzo didn't really pay attention, just signed for the 66, and because rules are rules, he had to take that 66, which put him 1 shot below Golby, no playoff, no nothing. Golby wins the green jacket. What a stupid I am. This would become the moment for which he is most famous. One of those unfair twists of history. You do something this glaring, it's going to overshadow a lot. And what's crazy about this for me is that on one hand, you can easily say it's DiVincenzo's fault. Of course, if he just spots the error and is a little bit more careful, maybe a little bit more patient, it is fully in his power to correct the mistake. But if you look at the story in full, it is not only his fault. I don't know why my mind went here, but I watched the excellent HBO miniseries about Chernobyl. This was maybe 2 years ago, and a big part of that show was how much had to go wrong, both before and during the meltdown of the nuclear reactor. How many lines of defense had to fail in order for that disaster to transpire? And I'm not comparing the two incidents, okay? I'm not comparing a nuclear meltdown in the Ukraine to somebody losing a golf tournament. Please don't put that on me, not even a little. But I've kind of framed the DiVincenzo incident in my head as a similar situation where there were certain fail-safes that should have been in place. There should have been these lines of defense that stopped any of this from happening. I consider DiVincenzo himself the second-to-last line of defense, and I'll explain that more. And he did fail, but so did a few other things. And to me, there are five lines of defense here that I've picked out that should have or could have stopped this in its tracks. DiVincenzo, I think, is at most about 20% to blame for this, if you want to put a number on it. And I know it's a little absurd to quantify it that way, but I do consider him culpable only in part and not even in large part. And of these five lines of defense, three are individuals, of which DiVincenzo is one. Two are institutions, and one of those institutions is Augusta National itself. I'm Shane Ryan, this is Local Knowledge, and today we're talking about one of the most controversial moments in golf history. And we are indebted, just like last week in our Cliff Roberts, Frank Stranahan podcast, to Kurt Sampson and his book The Masters, Golf, Money, and Power in Augusta, Georgia. This week we're also delving into a wonderful feature here at Digest on DiVincenzo by Jaime Diaz. We're going to reference that a bit. That was written in 2006. Jason Sobel, back when he wrote at ESPN, he has a piece we're going to use a lot. And the last really prominent one is an essay by Herbert Warren Wynn, the great sports writer in The New Yorker, written right after this tournament happened in 1968. And I want to thank my friend Dan Wachtel for digging that one up for me. So as I said before, I've chosen to approach this from the angle of who is to blame. And I think I've identified five culprits, but I use that word blame loosely. If these people and institutions had done things differently, I do think this disaster could have been avoided. But at the same time, history is funny, people are imperfect, institutions are imperfect, so it's less about blame, because who cares at this point? You're not going to run back the clock. And it's more about an explanation for the various things that had to go wrong for this scenario to play out. In other words, we're looking at how easily it could have been prevented. So let's start with that first line of defense that failed. This one's an institution, and it's the rules of golf. And rule number 38 in 1968 read as follows, quote, "If the competitor returns a score for any hole lower than actually played, he shall be disqualified. A score higher than actually played must stand as returned," end quote. Now, obviously, DiVincenzo falls in the second half of that one, but let's look at the first part, where you turn in a lower score than you actually had. Now, on the surface, that would actually seem like maybe a mode of possibly cheating, right? You're lying about your score, you shot a 72, you turned in a 71, you try to steal one on the rest of the field. It's understandable, at least on the surface, why you'd police that. But to my mind, it actually doesn't make sense at the highest levels of the game anymore. And it's still around, by the way. It's not Rule 38 anymore. It's USGA Rule 3.3B, Clause 3. And we had an example of it earlier this year when Jordan Spieth shot a 73 but signed for a 72 at the Genesis in Riviera. It was discovered. He was disqualified. This was a Friday, so he didn't get to play the weekend, which was bad for him, but bad for golf too. Spieth is a huge draw, and Riviera is a big tournament. He didn't get to play. Now, you may disagree with me here. I got into it on the Golf Channel with Eamon Lynch about this at the time. His take, and maybe your take too, is that keeping your score is part of the game. It's the responsibility of the player. The rule is the rule. Spieth himself handled it with really good grace. But my opinion is, come on. Every shot these guys take is tracked. You've got cameras everywhere, leaderboards, shot link especially. There are ways to cheat in golf. I'm not saying there's not. But turning in a lower score is not one of them, not in the PGA Tour. The Spieth case is proof. I mean, his mistake was caught immediately. You'd have to be insane to attempt this in some malicious way. And everybody knows he wasn't trying to cheat. Everybody. There was literally nobody who saw this and thought that there was anything nefarious there. So why is he being punished? Why is he being punished for something that was definitely not an attempt to cheat, that can be fixed with a stroke of the pen? I don't get it. I don't get it at all. But the DiVincenzo case is even less understandable to me because he signed for a score that was higher than he actually shot. Nobody's going to do that ever, for obvious reasons. You want the lowest score possible. You want the best finish possible. You want the most money possible. Very clear, right? And the rule at the time was you sign for a higher score, you get the higher score, and that's still the rule. Right there in 3.3b, Clause 3, back then it was Rule 38. And I don't understand why, and I never will. Again, some of you listening are not going to agree with me. I know that, but I just can't shake this. If you sign for a higher score than you actually made, it's obviously an accident. What is the point of punishing it? So that's my first culprit, the rule itself. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't now, it didn't then. In a sane world, I think you just say, hey, your scorecard was wrong. You gave yourself a worse score. Obviously, nobody would do that intentionally. Fix it. We're good to go. End of story. Now, lest you think this is a modern opinion that doesn't reflect contemporary thought at the time, let me read you an excerpt from April 1968. It's long, but I think it has some good perspective here. This is from Time Magazine. There's no author listed, but they wrote, quote, "Certainly nobody in his right mind gives himself a higher score for a hole than he actually shot. Why should he be penalized at all for such an obviously unintentional goof? Only in the case of a golfer who signs for a lower score does the question of intent arise, and even then, a quick investigation should satisfy officials as to whether cheating was involved. Many of DiVincenzo's fellow pros feel that it was Roberto who was cheated last week, and they are plumping for a change in the rule. Why, demands Frank Beard, should a purely technical error such as DiVincenzo's not be corrected, even if it is discovered hours later? Gardner Dickinson insists that if anybody should have been penalized, it was scorekeeper Aaron. Tom Weisskopf, number one money winner thus far in the 1968 tour, thinks that rulemakers should treat golfers as honorable gentlemen and let them keep their own scorecards. Adds Beard, we know what our score is and what the other fellow has. No one can cheat. End quote. Exactly. It was obvious back then. I think it's obvious now. And if you think my argument about how it's unneeded in modern golf is new, as in, okay, sure, we have shot link now and things are a little bit different than they might have been in 1968. Well, listen to what Herbert Warren Wynn said way back then. Again, this is April 1968. It will be familiar to you. He wrote, quote, any rule that can create a situation that hurts the winner as well as the loser and makes nonsense of a significant championship must be a bad rule. The main trouble, it seems to me, is that the philosophy behind the rule is seriously anachronistic where modern tournament golf is concerned. He talks about the origins of the game and how it was needed at one time, and he continues, however, modern tournament golf takes place under totally different conditions. In an event like the Masters, for instance, with hundreds of spectators lining each hole and millions more watching on television, no one is going to, quote, win with the pencil. Everybody knows the score. The problem today, when professional golf has become so popular, so high-powered, so rich, and so heavy with pressure, is to see to it that no one loses with the pencil. End quote. So that would be the first line of defense. We need sensible rules. We didn't have them. And that line of defense failed. And I'm going to depart briefly here from chronological order and focus on our third culprit, the third line of defense, because I think it's pretty closely related to that. And the third line of defense is a person, and it's Tommy Aaron. Aaron was DiVincenzo's playing partner that day, and it was his job to keep his playing partner's score. That is also still true today. Golf is a game of honor, but it seems like this is sort of a checks and balances situation, right? If you have somebody else keep your score, makes it a little bit harder to pull a fast one, maybe. But anyway, it was Aaron who marked DiVincenzo for a 4 instead of a 3 on the 17th hole. And you heard in that Time magazine quote, you know, people were saying it was Aaron who should be penalized. But what's interesting about it is you don't hear him get a lot of grief for that mistake when you read the old materials, ever. Bob Golby gets a ton of grief. You hear a lot about that. DiVincenzo, of course, gets a mixture of grief and sympathy, but Aaron kind of escapes. Nobody's out for his head. Nobody's clamoring for him to be held accountable, really. Now, in his 80s, Aaron wrote, or he dictated to a writer, a piece for Lynx magazine about that final round. And this is a good time to talk about what actually happened, because it was very, very dramatic. Golby actually started the day one shot off the lead, and this was a very crowded leaderboard. It was Gary Player at 6-under. He had the solo lead. Golby was among a pack of 5 golfers at 5-under. The others were Frank Beard, Raymond Floyd, Bruce Devlin and Don January. And at 4 under was DiVincenzo, Lee Trevino, and Miller Barber. And Tommy Aaron was at 3 under, and he was DiVincenzo's playing partner, as we said. So it's that kind of leaderboard where in order to win, there are so many jammed up there that it's going to be somebody who shoots 65, 66. Too many good players there to kind of limp to the finish line. That Sunday was DiVincenzo's 45th birthday. Golby was 39. And they quickly emerged as the big forces in the final round. Player dropped. He'd end up shooting a 72. By the time DiVincenzo was at the turn, he was 9 under and he was leading the tournament. Golby got to 8 under at the turn and they just kept going. When DiVincenzo got to the 17th hole, he was a shot up on Golby, but Golby was playing 15, about 30 yards from him. They were both on the fairway. And it seems that they hit their approach shots almost simultaneously. DiVincenzo hit his iron to 4 feet. Golby hits his second just a moment later to 8 feet. And remember, the 15th is a par 5, so for him, that's going to be an eagle putt. They get on the green. DiVincenzo sinks his relatively easy birdie. And as he watched Tommy Aaron putt, he hears a roar. Golby on 15 green has made his eagle putt. And now they're tied at 12 under. They are absolutely on fire. And this is a point I would like to emphasize. And Herbert Warren Wind in the New Yorker, he makes this point. This was great golf. Maybe one of the best final rounds in a major anyone had ever seen. Certainly up there with the best. To the point that Jack Nicklaus shoots a 67. Bert Yancey shoots a 65. These guys, who were very much in contention, aren't even in the picture. But all of that is lost in the end because of the controversy. But at least know, at least, you know, flag it in your brain. This was spectacular stuff. And that moment when DiVincenzo is on 17 and he makes this birdie and then they hear the roar of the eagle putt going down for Golby on 15 was so intense. And you can imagine watching on TV. Actually, you don't even have to imagine it. You can go see it on YouTube. The last hour or so is on there. It was so intense that Tommy Aaron forgot to record a score for DiVincenzo. He forgot to write down the 3 in the moment. Now, another important part of this, they go to 18, DiVincenzo makes bogey. And so when he went to the scorer's table, he was distraught. He thought by making bogey, he had just lost the Masters. Remember, Golby was at 12. He was now at 11. And here's what Tommy Aaron wrote about that sequence. It's a long passage, but a pretty great one. Quote, at 17, Roberto hit it stiff and holed for a 6 birdie to the roar of the crowd. But almost immediately, an even bigger roar rose from the 15th green where Golby had made eagle to pull even at 12 under. It was a pretty wild moment. So wild that I neglected to pencil in Roberto's score before leaving the green. At the 18th tee, all I could think was, gee, if Roberto can par this, he'll have a great chance of winning. But he pushed his drive, leaving no shot to the green, and he made a bogey 5. Understandably, he was distraught. We exited the green and sat down at the scorer's table. Back then, that's all it was, a table beside the green. As you checked your card, folks would be leaning in, making comments, asking you questions. I was still thinking, gosh, what a shame, as I wrote in the last 2 scores for Roberto. Bogey 5 on the last and par 4 at 17. A 4 that was sadly, infamously incorrect. Then I slid the card across the table for Roberto to check. But he was still in semi-shock over his finish. He just sat there, head in hands. End quote. What if the highlight of your travels was the traveling itself? Picture this, American Airlines Admirals Club membership, VIP treatment, and more, and your vacation hasn't even started yet. With the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard, you'll be looking forward to the journey as much as the destination. It's the only card with complimentary membership to American Airlines Admirals Club, so you can feel like you're on cloud 9 before you're even in the air. And it rewards each purchase with American Airlines Advantage miles for your travels and loyalty points toward Advantage status. You can even earn up to 20,000 additional loyalty points after qualifying activities. So, a higher level of status and the high-end treatment that comes with it are more within your reach. Give yourself more to look forward to in every trip on American Airlines with the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard. Apply today at citi.com/executive. and earn 70,000 Advantage bonus miles after qualifying purchases. Citi Advantage, travel on. So he writes the score much later. He's not thinking straight. He gives the scorecard over DiVincenzo is beside himself. He thinks he's just blown what might be his last chance to win a major championship. He's right, just a little ahead of time. And just then, as if things couldn't get more cluttered, an Augusta National member comes up and says, Roberto, they want you in the press room. Can you imagine that today? Imagine the media demanding, you know, somebody like Scottie Scheffler, he's waiting to see if he might have to go into a playoff before the tournament's over, demanding, hey, you got to get to the press room to talk to us. That was apparently normal then. And you can guess, in these circumstances, what DiVincenzo does. He doesn't care what's on the scorecard. He's heartbroken. He's being dragged away. This is the least of his concerns. He signs it without really studying it like he needs to. And just after he leaves, Aaron looks at the scoreboard, sees that DiVincenzo has a 65 up there on the big scoreboard at the Masters, and says, uh-oh, I just had him for a 66. And he runs and he catches him and he delivers the bad news. And DiVincenzo, just in the moment, says, let's just change it. And Aaron, in that piece that he wrote, he says, quote, to this day, I'm convinced those words were totally innocent, a reflection of the shock he was in. Nonetheless, I was taken aback. Roberto, I said, we can't do that. It would be breaking the rules. End quote. Now, I don't know about you, but if I were Tommy Aaron and I made that mistake and cost somebody at the chance of the Masters, I would be pretty willing to change the score. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Let's get it. Let's change the score. If somebody catches me, so be it. But I don't want to live with that on my conscience that I cost somebody this chance because of a clerical error. The greater justice in my mind would be just to fudge that number right back to 3, what it should be. I just, you know, that's just me. I'm a big time ethical guy when it comes to cheating in terms of bettering your score. But in this case, I think there's a greater justice to be served. You may disagree. Anyway, DiVincenzo, when he hears that from Aaron, snaps back to reality. And of course, Murphy's Law, what happens on the course? Golby bogey 17. Ends up at 11 under, just like DiVincenzo. But he wins because of that scorecard error that moves DiVincenzo to 10 under. So this is actually, again, the third line of defense that fails, Tommy Aaron. And Aaron writes at the conclusion of his piece, quote, in truth, there were no winners that day. Roberto was the most tragic, but poor Bob got tons of hate mail. And I took some hits as well, despite a defense from Jack Nicklaus. There's no way it was Tommy's fault, Nicklaus told the media. It was Roberto's responsibility to check his card. I can tell you the demons I fought through 5 years later to win a green jacket myself. Ironically, in the final round that year, my playing companion, Johnny Miller, recorded an incorrect score for me on one hole. But I checked my card and caught it. End quote. That's pretty funny. It's funny that's Johnny Miller, of all people, trying to deliver some cosmic revenge from the universe, but Tommy Aaron's been there. He was going to catch that error. So apparently, as you see from that passage, Tommy Aaron did get some heat. But looking back, other than him saying that he got heat, it's hard to find much, really. Now, I said before we skipped out of turn. That was the third line of defense. The second line of defense that failed after the rules themselves, but before Tommy Aaron, was Augusta National. 2 weeks ago, we did our Cliff Roberts podcast. Roberts was the co-founder of Augusta National with Bobby Jones. He was the chairman for about 4 decades. Incredibly interesting guy, powerful, good at making very powerful friends like Jones and Dwight Eisenhower, but also paranoid, stubborn, and he ran Augusta with an iron fist. Everything about the paranoia that we associate with Augusta that is changed in modern times, but the remnants of it, that's all because of Cliff Roberts. And there's a great moment in a Golf Digest piece by Frank Hannigan, who not only a good writer, but he had been the senior executive director of the USGA, and he wrote this in a story about Cliff Roberts, quote, needless to say, he could be stubborn. USGA executive director Joe Dye had warned him that having only an umbrella table behind the 18th green where players return the official scorecards to an inexperienced Augusta National member was dangerous. The USGA had been burned at a women's open in 1957 when Jackie Pung returned an erroneous card at an unprotected umbrella table. Thus, the 1968 Roberto DiVincenzo scorecard disaster at the Masters happened both because Roberts was careless and because there was nobody there to insist on cross-checking the cards. End quote. Joe Dye would later become the first commissioner of the PGA Tour. He knew what he was talking about. The Pung situation was really bad. She actually won the tournament. She turned in a scorecard where the total score was even correct, but one hole was wrong. It had no bearing on the outcome. but instead of winning, she was disqualified. You know, imagine, again, I keep saying this, but imagine that happening in modern times. Scottie Scheffler wins the Masters by 2. Shoots a 68 on Sunday. Turns in a card that says 68. But on the, let's say, the 15th hole, he makes birdie on the par 5. But he puts down an eagle. He puts down a 3 by accident. Doesn't affect the score, right? His score is correct that he turns in the scorecard. Doesn't affect the outcome. And you disqualify him from the tournament and Wyndham Clark wins. That would be mind-blowing. And these are still the rules. These are still the rules today. It could absolutely happen. But it would be the story of the millennium in golf. You would never stop hearing about it. Now, again, it is on the player. It's on DiVincenzo to a certain extent. But Dai identified that not having a specific designated covered spot or even a little building where players can come in and concentrate and double check and make sure the scorecard is right opens you to errors like this. It happened to him. It was a disaster. And he warned Cliff Roberts. He warned him about this exact thing. Roberts didn't do anything. So that's one way Augusta fails DiVincenzo. Now, again, you add on to that the fact that as he's in the position to sign under this umbrella, another member is dragging him to the meeting area. Another failure of Augusta. It creates a perfect storm for some inattention to detail to happen. And CBS was broadcasting that year. Pat Summerall was, you know, the main play-by-play guy. And Roberts called up to him when the scorecard issue came to light. And he said, don't say anybody won. Okay, we've got an issue down here. We've got a problem. Now, meanwhile, what's wild is Golby, when he's on the 18th tee, he sliced his tee shot into the woods. He was on the verge of making bogey, but he made par. He saved his par. And then something else potentially interesting emerged. And Kurt Sampson, in his book about the Masters, wrote about exactly what was really weird and bizarre about the situation that unfolded. Quote, Ann wrote down a 4 on 17, a hole the whole world had just seen DiVincenzo make a 3 on. Roberto signed the card, so the score stood. Or did it? The Masters is neither a USGA nor a PGA event, although the USGA ties were very strong among the membership, including the first member, who'd won the US Open 4 times, of course, Bobby Jones. So in theory, it could do what it wanted. End quote. In other words, they weren't even beholden to these rules. They could choose to proceed exactly as they wanted to proceed here. If it seemed wrong to them to penalize DiVincenzo, they didn't have to. And so while Summerall is on air, to quote Sampson, he's filibustering, you know, he's reading scores, doing whatever he can to eat up time. But eventually they start talking about DiVincenzo and something strange happening. They don't know what it is yet. And they're saying things like, as they show him on camera, he doesn't seem pleased. And Summerall doesn't know if there's a playoff. He says there's no official word that there will not be. And at the same time, a delegation of Augusta members, including Cliff Roberts, sets out for Bobby Jones's cabin. And they turn to him. They say, what should we do? And Bobby Jones, you have to know, this is 1968. He would pass in 1971. He was extremely unwell with a disease that would kill him. And he barely even got to Augusta that year. In fact, this would be the first year that he's not at the, you know, the award, the Green Jacket ceremony on television, running that whole thing. So Bobby Jones, even when Herbert Warren Wynn visits him, Bobby Jones is not quite himself. He still manages to, you know, deal with it with class and grace because that's what he always did. But he's not healthy. And so they go to him, and this is really putting a guy on the spot who's maybe not in a position where he wants to deal with this, but Bobby Jones ends up being the one who ruled in favor of Bob Golby. But it's important to know he didn't want to. This is a great detail that you can't find in many places. I found it in Herbert Warren Wynn's New Yorker article, but many books read many articles, they just say, well, Bob Jones said the rule is the rule, Bob Golby wins. That's not how it went down. Here's how it actually went down in that cabin. Again, this is from the New Yorker. Quote, as head of the Masters, Bob Jones always wants to be kept informed of any and all problems. He was watching the concluding stages of the tournament on television in his cottage with his son, Robert T. Jones III, when word was brought to him that DiVincenzo had signed an incorrect card. Before taking any action, the four co-chairmen of the tournament rules committee wanted to have Jones' opinion, and along with Cliff Roberts, they quickly assembled at his cottage. Jones made it very clear that his primary concern was to find some way, if there was a way, of waiving the rule that would cost DiVincenzo a tie and the chance to win in a playoff. In the opinion of Isaac Granger, a former president of the USGA and the most experienced rules man present, the only avenue was to make the freest interpretation possible of what constituted an official return of a scorecard by a player to the scoring committee. However, the precedent, he said, was that once a player had left the roped-off area around the last green, as DiVincenzo had to go to the television room, the card must be regarded as officially returned. Jones then asked the group if there was any other loophole they could think of. There wasn't, he was told. Not without violating the rules. That's all I want to know, Jones said. End quote. So he wanted to do it, but he felt he couldn't in the end. And as Sampson wrote in his book, The Masters, from a marketing angle, this was an absolute disaster. Here's what Sampson wrote, quote, few people in golf disagree with the decision, except Charlie Sifford, who saw it as discrimination against an Argentinian, but hundreds of columnists and thousands of fans denounced the club, the tournament, even, nonsensically, Golby. The DiVincenzo incident marked the lowest ever point in Masters public relations. End quote. It's not easy to describe the feeling of what happened when this news came out at Augusta, but luckily we once again have Herbert Warren Wind. He writes, quote, I have gone into this detail about the DiVincenzo-Golby duel for two reasons. First, golf of this surpassing quality, a 65 and a 66, under the harshest strain, deserves to be described, for as far as I know, never before have two men thrusting and parrying on the last round of a major championship both scored as low. Second, I think it is important to record the golf that Golby and DiVincenzo played because it is almost bound to be forgotten in the cruel, depressing aftermath of that memorable afternoon. And he continues. I know that the moment I heard the official announcement, I was struck dumb. All of a sudden, it was Alice in Wonderland time. The minute before, we had been talking apples, and now we weren't even talking grapes. We were talking one-horse shays. I had felt like that once before in golf in 1957 at Winged Foot, when 40 minutes after Jackie Pung won the U.S. Women's Open Championship, a voice over the loudspeaker system informed us that she hadn't. Her winning total was correct, but she had been disqualified for signing a scorecard on which her playing partner had put her down for a 5 and not a 6 on the fourth hole. I had hoped never to see another day like that one at Winged Foot, and here we were again. End quote. So that's the second line of defense that fails here. If the first is the bad rules, the second is Augusta. Cliff Roberts, for not designing a better scoring area, which he did the very next year, by the way, while denying to reporters that anything had changed because he didn't want to publicly admit he was wrong. And then maybe, you know, in a small way, Augusta was culpable for dragging DiVincenzo away from the media area because he had to go do his TV interview. And then Jones, Bob Jones, or the rules officials, arguably, for not resorting to common sense, not finding a way to give DiVincenzo his playoff. Again, people are going to disagree there. Sampson says in the passage we just read that most golf people thought they did the right thing in a tough situation. That might be a bit broad to say most golf people, but it's not like it hurt Jones's reputation very much. You know, the Masters certainly survived, but Augusta had a chance to stop this a few different ways, and the infrastructure and the decision-making just were not there. Third line of defense, again, was Tommy Arum. We talked about him. Fourth line of defense is DiVincenzo for not catching the mistake. I am on record as saying before, I'll say it again, it would have been very hard in that moment to focus on the card. He's a professional. He should have, yes. But it's very understandable to me why he didn't. Now, it might be worth talking about DiVincenzo a little bit more. Sampson, in his book, called both him and Tommy Arum, quote, head in the clouds, guys. But I think Jaime Diaz's profile on DiVincenzo in Golf Digest from 2006, DiVincenzo was 83 years old then, I think it is maybe one of the best resources we have for what this guy was like. And I can tell you, now I hope you go read it because it's a great read, but I can tell you that DiVincenzo comes off very well. You're going to like him. The article starts off like this, quote, Roberto DiVincenzo's meaty and calloused hands have hit as many golf balls, not to mention held more trophies, as those of any man alive. But when he extends a brawny arm to welcome a visitor, his grip is soft. Bienvenido a mi país, he says. End quote. Now this is a profile of a great golfer who, again, was much older. But even then, he couldn't stay away from the course. Gets mad at how bad he plays, even though he's driving the ball 260 yards and he's scoring in the 70s. I wouldn't mind that, but he's still frustrated. He says things like, there's nothing more ridiculous than an old man straining when he can't reach a par 4 green in 2 because he's hitting dead into a heavy wind. Jaime Diaz asks him if he's going to go to Hoylake for an upcoming Open Championship. It's the course where he won his only major, and he said, quote, I don't know. I don't want to go and not come back, end quote. That's his kind of self-deprecating humor. But even in the prime of his life, as Diaz points out, this guy was a homebody. He loved Argentina. He lived a life of what he called simple abundance as the fifth of seven children of a house painter, all of whom had passed when Jaime Diaz visited him in 2006. DiVincenzo's mother had died when he was 8 years old, and he worked as a kid as a pond boy to make money. And a pond boy was somebody who you might imagine fished balls out of the pond at the golf course across the street. He went from there to caddying, then he began to play. One of the funny stories Diaz tells is that he'd play these other caddies in closest to the hole contests where they would play for movie money to go to the movie house. And the rule was you couldn't touch the other guy about to shoot, but you could yell anything you wanted at him and jump and do whatever else you could think of. Complete distraction, and he won those most of the time. Dropped out of school at age 15, became an assistant at a golf course in the country, got very good at the game with the time to practice, and then he started playing and winning a lot. We're going to skip over a lot of his biography, but by 1948, he finally went to the U.S., lived in Mexico City to be close to the PGA Tour, and he did win a couple events, including the Colonial, but he was never quite comfortable in America, and so eventually he moved back to Argentina. He played and won a lot in Europe, built up a big following, the British loved him, and he peaked in his career a little bit late by winning the Open Championship in 1967, 40, would have been 44 years old then, by outdueling Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus on Sunday. Again, that was a year before the Masters that we're talking about. And meanwhile, he's winning at ridiculous volumes in Argentina and Latin America. Again, the guy won over 200 times in his career, if you count all the senior events and everything. But at that Open Championship in 1967, he came to the 16th, drove the ball down the right side. It's a par 5, and he hit this miraculous 3-wood to secure the win, essentially. And here's what he wrote about that shot in Argentina later. Quote, "It was the best shot of my life. It produces a mixture of pleasure, happiness, wisdom, self-esteem, as if one were being caressed by clouds. It's hard to explain. You have to feel it." End quote. So you can tell he's an emotional, a passionate guy, a sensualist in many ways. And Diaz asked him about leaving something on the table, you know, about not playing in America more. This is a guy who skipped the Masters and the U.S. Open all the time, only ever played in two PGA championships. Do you have any regrets? And DiVincenzo said this, quote, "I don't regret. I never made a lot of money, but enough to live well. Anyway, there are only two kinds of money, the kind you spend and the kind you leave behind. In one way, I'm glad I'm more famous because it left me more free." End quote. And by the way, the amount he missed out on at the Masters, speaking of money, by not getting a chance to win was $5,000. That was the difference. But the endorsement deals that come from winning the Masters could have been far more lucrative. People at that time estimated them to be worth six figures. That part doesn't seem to have bothered him. He went on in that same vein, quote, "My character is more comfortable where I have no obligation. I was not like Palmer or Nicklaus or Gary Player. I wouldn't like to be Tiger Woods. Their life has been one of work, of sacrifice, of leaving many beautiful things in life behind to dedicate to success. Yes, I played all over the world, but more in my own time." End quote. And the pictures in that piece are of him having fun with his friends, eating and drinking, and he'd go on having fun for another decade. He didn't pass until 2017 at age 94. What if the highlight of your travels was the traveling itself? Picture this: American Airlines Admirals Club membership, VIP treatment, and more. And your vacation hasn't even started yet. With the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard, you'll be looking forward to the journey as much as the destination. It's the only card with complimentary membership to American Airlines Admirals Club, so you can feel like you're on cloud nine before you're even in the air. And it rewards each purchase with American Airlines Advantage miles for your travels and loyalty points toward Advantage status. You can even earn up to 20,000 additional loyalty points after qualifying activities. So, a higher level of status and the high-end treatment that comes with it are more within your reach. Give yourself more to look forward to in every trip on American Airlines with the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard. Apply today at citi.com/executive and earn 70,000 Advantage bonus miles after qualifying purchases. Citi Advantage. Travel on. And so you take that guy with his great skill, his priorities, and his look on life. This is somebody that everybody liked. One great story he tells is that He was playing once with Jerry Barber and Charlie Sifford, two really tough personalities. You know, Charlie Sifford, we did a podcast on. He had reason to be kind of grumpy, but not very beloved by most players, and they hated each other, but they both liked Roberto. And he told the story that playing this round, Sifford would say to him, "Roberto, tell that son of a bitch he's away." And Barber would say, "Roberto, ask that idiot what he had on that hole." And Barber would tell him he was a bum, right? Barber would go up to him and say, "You know, you're a bum," because Barber was a tough guy, and he thought DiVincenzo was soft. He wasn't playing to his full potential, wasn't tough enough. And DiVincenzo would just laugh at him when he said that. And Barber couldn't help but like him, and he'd try to help him. And Barber didn't like many people, so that kind of shows you that this dynamic that this guy had with other people. So imagine him at 45. In that situation at the 68 Masters, he's emotional because he just blew it, but he's got a pretty good perspective for a professional golfer. And everything at that scoring table seems designed to distract him, to take him away from the scorecard. And knowing who he is and what he was like and how he reacted, again, your mileage may vary. I have a lot of trouble blaming Roberto DiVincenzo for signing that incorrect scorecard. Now, the fifth and final line of defense that failed that day is by far the most controversial, and it's Bob Golby. Here are the basics of what happened with Golby. He was the champion by the rules, and he accepted it. And in the final 10 minutes of the YouTube broadcast, you can watch. It's easy to find. Just, you know, search 1968 Masters. It's on their official channel. You can see him getting ready for the interview. You know, we can do a whole play-by-play of these interesting moments here between the end of play and when they sit down for the interview. Pat Summerall is still wondering if there's going to be a playoff the next day. He kicks it to Frank Gifford, who's in the cabin, and introduces Cliff Roberts, who says, "You know, I'm going to talk a little bit longer than usual because Roberto DiVincenzo isn't here yet." You know, he was being pulled away. He tells us that Bobby Jones isn't feeling well. He's not going to be there like most years. Then he kicks it to a man named John Winters, an Augusta member from Tulsa, who says in a massive understatement that, quote, "something different always happens at the Masters." And then he goes over the unusual thing that brings him great distress. And he says that under the rules of golf, Bob Golby is the winner and Roberto is the runner-up. He says he regrets it, but he has no choice. And that's how it was broken, by the way. That's how everybody knew. Summerall didn't know before that. This was how the nation watching on TV understood what had happened. And this is really good drama. You should absolutely go watch this on YouTube. It's, again, on the Masters channel. But after speaking to the guy who had won the lowest AM, he goes to Roberto DiVincenzo first. And DiVincenzo can't help but smile ruefully when Winters says, "Well, it's not a very happy birthday present for you, is it?" And DiVincenzo says, quote, "I can't forget two things today. What I did on the first hole and what I did on the last hole," end quote. And again, he says, "What a stupid I am." And he says he looked at the scorecard and he really didn't see any numbers. And he feels sorry for himself because he doesn't think he'll get this close again. He says all this right on TV. But he congratulates Golby and he jokes that maybe Golby was responsible for the mistake since he put so much pressure on him. And Roberts interjects to deliver a special message from Bob Jones to DiVincenzo. And he says, quote, "In our hearts, we will always regard you as one of the two winners of this tournament." And it's pretty great in its way. And then they go to Golby and he speaks for a couple minutes and he says, you know, after thanking everybody and talking about his day, he says he regrets what happened and he says he's sorry for Roberto. And Winters says, kind of cuts him off and says, "We all feel that way, but under the circumstances, you are the winner." And it's amazing here how much they're on DiVincenzo's side. It's like they already know they screwed it up. They already know how bad this is. And they're trying to preemptively make up for it with words as best they can because they know they've got a PR disaster on their hands. But here's the thing about Golby that you have to address. Very classy in the moment. But it comes back to the idea that the Masters isn't strictly beholden to the USGA or PGA's rules. In theory, he could have gone the extra mile and asked for a playoff or insisted on one. You know, "I'm not going to accept the green jacket because it's not fair. I want a playoff." Now, there are people you present the idea to. Kurt Sampson is one of them. And they will pronounce that absurd or unfair. "You're being unfair to Golby," or something like that. And I can see what they're saying. It would have required an extraordinary act. But I also can't help but think of Jack Nicklaus with his concession at the 69 Ryder Cup. People who rose to the occasion, even in the cauldron of pressure, even when winning or losing was in the balance. And I'm not comparing those two situations, but He didn't even make the gesture. And I may be holding him to too high of a standard, but I think you can argue without being a jerk or without operating from too much historical hindsight, you can at least argue that he should have. I don't know if this is the right standard, but I would have hoped if I'm in that situation, and I've got to get much better at golf before I am, but I would have hoped that if I were in that situation, I would have done that. To see in that moment that you just can't accept this. I'm sorry, I'm not accepting the green jacket. It's not fair what happened to Roberto. You can argue, and I think I am arguing, that it wasn't enough for him to simply express his condolences. And I wasn't the only one to say that, of course. And here's what Golby said about that later in life. Quote, I can see how Roberto might feel I could have changed things by asking for a playoff. But even if I had wanted a playoff, doesn't mean there would have been one. I couldn't change the rules of golf or what they had decided. I mean, if I'm playing with a friend of mine and he hits one OB, I can't go, just hit another one. End quote. But notice the phrasing. Even if I had wanted one, doesn't mean there would have been one. But it also doesn't mean there wouldn't have been one. Who knows? We don't. But we do know these guys were deciding things on the fly with an ailing Bobby Jones in his cabin. This was very ad hoc. Things were changeable. And Golby might be one of the guys who actually could have changed something in the moment. And there were other things that happened that must have annoyed him. That night, both Golby and DiVincenzo ate dinner with Roberts. Usually it's just the champion. Roberts later sent DiVincenzo a sterling silver cigarette box with the signatures of the previous winners, which they only ever did for the champion before then. And then some of DiVincenzo's friends made him a custom green jacket that he would wear on special occasions at his club in Argentina. And what's wild about this is that you could argue Golby got the worst deal. He got hate mail, both from people who didn't think he deserved to win and from people who had all kinds of wrong information, who thought, you know, he was the one who sabotaged DiVincenzo's scorecard. As Jaime Diaz wrote, it took him years to find peace with the outcome. And the official story is they're good friends. But when DiVincenzo spoke to Diaz in 2006, he said there was plenty of tension still. Here's what he said, quote, I don't know. Golby seemed to feel I was at fault for him not getting the credit for the victory. He took it very emotionally. And for many years when I saw him, he would say things to me that bothered me. I felt he was pushing me, but I put up with it because I know he was bitter. And because I don't have the English to discuss things with him equally. So I always had the white flag. End quote. And even more directly, he says this. Quote, of course it was my fault for signing the incorrect scorecard, but the way the public reacted wasn't my fault. It was his fault. He could have resolved it. All he had to do was say one thing before they presented him with the green jacket. Sorry, I prefer that we play off tomorrow. That would have been sufficient. Then everything is fixed. I think he didn't see the situation clearly. He's much more intelligent than me. He has university education, which I don't have. But maybe I have a better feel for people. End quote. I agree with him. I really do. And this is part of the... this really plays into the whole thing of how Golby got the worst end of the stick in this situation. Because even now, you know, Golby has passed away, but you have people like me on a podcast saying this guy should have done something. You know, kind of calling into question his behavior and even posthumously tarnishing the fact that he technically won a green jacket. So it's very tough all the way around. And again, your mileage may vary. Some people will hear me saying that about Golby and really be annoyed with me. That's okay. It's just my opinion. But Golby, to his credit, Diaz went to him after he got all these quotes from DiVincenzo. He admitted that tension. And he said this to Diaz, quote, yeah, it was awkward between us for a year or so. And that may have been mostly me. Because Roberto was getting a lot of the credit, and I was getting mail saying I had to be the worst SOB who ever lived. It was hard to take because a lot of people thought that I had played with Roberto and intentionally messed up his score. End quote. NBC offered them $100,000 to do a playoff on live TV. Roberto said yes, Golby said no. But eventually they teamed up to do a commercial in 2000 that joked about the moment. And they played together in a tournament called the Legends of Golf. And Golby raised a good point, which is that, you know, he spent a lot of tough years thinking about this tournament, and it ate at him, but it got easier for him the further it slipped back in time. He joked that when he went to the champions dinner years later, the young guys would basically just ask him, hey, when did you win? And he'd say 1968, and they wouldn't know any details. You know, nice job. Congratulations. Golby passed in 2022. He had had quite a career himself, 11 PGA Tour wins, finished runner-up at the PGA Championship and US Open, And it does seem like eventually he made peace with what happened in 68. You know, even when DiVincenzo had some pointed quotes for him in that Diaz article, he took it in stride. But he was the fifth and final line of defense that failed that day. And as for DiVincenzo, on one hand you think, considering the guy's perspective, this is probably the best person for this to happen to. He handled it better than anyone could have, but he never stopped thinking about it. And the way he resolved it for himself was not to put it out of mind, but to contextualize it. And as Diaz wrote, he took the metaphysical route. I love this from DiVincenzo. He said, quote, "For me, the Masters hasn't ended. No se terminó. Technically, the ending was legal, but there's something missing. The winner hasn't yet emerged. It lacks an ending. But I don't think it's a playoff that's going to be settled on Earth. It's going to be in heaven, providing we both get there. I think we are both good men, so I assume we will both end up in the same place." End quote. And that's quite a conclusion for him to reach after this strange chapter in his career, a richly decorated career which would nonetheless be defined by that chapter. As an old man, he came to think of it as something ongoing. That just as life doesn't end with death, if you're of a religious mindset anyway, guess what? The 1968 Masters doesn't end either. Local Knowledge is produced by Greg Gottfried, with editorial guidance from Sam Weinman. Our music for today's episode is called The Guitar of the Pampas by Argentina. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to Local Knowledge wherever you get your podcasts, and check out Golf Digest's other podcasts, The Loop and Golf IQ. If you're a Golf Digest Plus subscriber, try out our new exclusive newsletters, Low Net, Golf IQ, and Undercover Pro. Have a great day.
Hello, I'm Luke Cardenine, the host of the Golf IQ podcast, and we've got some very exciting news here in Golf Digest land. It's a new newsletter available exclusively to Golf Digest Plus members, and it'll land in your inbox once a week. It's the greatest newsletter in all the land here at Golf Digest, but I admit there is an upstart rival in the ranks, and it goes by the name of the Low Net newsletter with Sam Weinman, who's here right now. Sam, what's the lowdown on your newsletter?
Well, my newsletter, Luke, is the reason that you are competing for second place at best. My newsletter, as you said, is called Low Net. It's geared towards golfers like myself who are very much in the middle of the pack at your course or your club. It's a game I live and breathe, and I'm obsessed with getting better.
No, in all seriousness, it's a great read. It's full of not just really interesting and helpful stuff, but really relatable stuff from the man who probably loves golf the most of anybody here at Golf Digest. So head over to golfdigest.com/plus. Sign up and start enjoying both of these awesome newsletters each and every week.